Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of The Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, where our mission is to make visionary community improvement the norm in the social change arena rather than the exception. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about this sector's potential for creating visionary social change. I'm so pleased to welcome Alana Shaikh as my guest on Making Change. For almost two decades, Alana has held positions with the U.S. State Department, with the United Nations, and with government-contracted consulting teams, all focused on global health issues. Along the way, Alana has become an author, a blogger, and an overall advocate for the health of the people on this planet. Alana is a senior TED Fellow and has authored a book for TED titled What's Killing Us? A look at the most important challenges and issues in global wellness. Most recently, Alana and two colleagues have co-founded AidSource, an independent network connecting on-the-ground aid workers and NGO staff with each other all around the world. Given her in-the-trenches experience with the issues of global health, having seen her share of what doesn't work, and more importantly, what does work, it is my pleasure to have Alana Shaikh share her observations with us today here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is Alana Shaikh. Welcome, Alana. I'm so glad to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm glad we can talk.
Oh, me too. Tell our listeners where you are calling in from.
I am actually currently in Doha in Qatar. I'm here for the UN Conference on Trade and Development. Normally, I'm in Dushanbe, Tajikistan.
Wonderful. Well, I'm just so glad to have you, and I love the fact that technology allows us to do this so seamlessly.
Yes.
Very fun. When I do these interviews, I always start with the same question, and given your breadth of experience, would love to know, when you see change happening in communities, what do you see undergirding that change? What are the factors that are supporting that change?
Something I've been thinking a lot about lately is about connectedness. It's about how do people get the information they need, how do they share that information, and how do they access the services they need. And a lot of it that sort of underscores our whole lives is how we connect to other people. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about that in terms of the technology that we use for connection and how we can improve people's lives that way. And I'm also thinking in terms of just, you know, face-to-face interpersonal communications. Mm-hmm. So I think that when we see change coming in global health, it's going to be centered around better ways of connecting people.
It's always so interesting because we always think about the content, that it's going to be a pill, a drug, but it really is the systems underpinning that, of how do people get it?
And how do they learn from each other? I mean, so much of health is still human behavior choices and not actually about a drug or a pill or a service. It's about what each individual person chooses for their life and how can people learn from each other and learn the best practices instead of the bad ones.
Can you share a story about where you've seen that be effective?
The classic story for this is a concept called positive deviance. In any village, there's always one family that's doing a little better than everybody else. They have the same income level, they have access to the same things, but somehow they manage to make everything stretch a little farther. Their kids are a little bit healthier, their family's a little bit richer. And what positive deviance does is try to capture that knowledge and then share it with everybody else in the village so everybody can be a little bit richer and everybody can be a little bit healthier. And there's this idea that a lot of information you need is already present in a community. Mm-hmm. You just have to find a way to make sure everybody can access it.
So where have you seen that happen?
Certainly in Tajikistan, where I live right now, in Tajik villages. The Soviet Union, its massive impact on Tajikistan eliminated a lot of traditional knowledge about things like food preparation or farming or canning. And some families have been able to hang on to that information better than other families, depending on how fully they integrated into the Soviet Union. And so certainly you can see now in Tajik villages that people who remember the old ways are actually healthier. And in many ways, you know, they may become village and community leaders as they start to teach other people.
So how does one take that knowledge, find that family, and then share that knowledge?
Well, often there's different NGOs have sort of specific positive deviance approaches they've laid out. There's one called the Hearth Model, which is based around better food. specifically targeted at finding people who are doing better things with local food. Mm-hmm. But you can also sort of look at it in a broader sense. One thing you can do is take a continuous quality improvement approach where you actually form a community committee to look at what the community does and identify people who are doing it really well and identify ways they can do it better. So often it's about providing a structured way people can connect to each other, because it may not be comfortable to just sort of show up to someone and say, hey, teach me, or to figure out what someone to teach. But if you create a community structure where people can come together, it flows more naturally.
Do you find those structures already in communities?
Some communities, you know, have sort of a strong community identity, and they already have a formal or an informal committee. One thing the Soviet Union was good at was at teaching people to establish committees. So teaching plenty of local organizational structures.
Interesting. So you're building on what they already have, whether it was positive at the time or not.
Yes.
What have you seen effective in bringing people together?
Well, what you want to be is you want to be a catalytic outsider. You want to be an outsider who's a useful catalyst for things that are already there. Because you can't impose something. You can't come up with a big idea and then try to push it onto a community and get them to adopt it. Instead, you have to sort of help people maybe to connect outside their social group or their economic class to be sort of the neutral third party who allows people to link to each other.
How do you do that? I mean, how do you get people to connect outside their social group? I mean, you can't just hold a meeting and hope people will come.
Well, Tajikistan, pretty much every village has a school, and almost every village has some level of health structure, even if it's just a single health worker in a room. Mm-hmm. And these are structures that already belong to the community. So one way you can help people connect is to link it to that existing structure. You know, how can this community improve the health facility? How can this community improve the school?
It's interesting because we don't think of a school as the connecting place. We think of a school as a school. We think of a health right. center as a clinic. But you're right, that is the hub at the middle of what could be a really intricate web.
Especially in a culture where people have large families and they live in multi-generational family groups, it means that just about everybody has a link to the local school. I mean, in the U.S., you know, everybody doesn't feel connected to the neighborhood elementary school because you don't necessarily have children that age or children at all. But if you're in Tajikistan, you know, you're living in a family with three or four generations, and certainly you have a niece, a nephew, a grandchild who's in that school, even if you don't have school-age children right now.
And you think about communities in the U.S., they have something else. There's always going to be the place that people gather. You just don't think about it as such.
There is. I mean, I think it was in, was it Trenton or Newark, where they were totally heartbroken, their only Starbucks closed, because that was a place the community connected to, and it was a symbol of pride. I mean, yeah, every community has something.
And it's identifying what that is and working with that.
Yes. And that's just a slow process.
Yeah, well, I love the term catalytic outsider. It really sort of busts the thinking about how we think of outsiders coming in versus looking at the potential of what's already there and igniting that potential.
Right. And I'm actually involved in another project that's looking at connectedness and information sharing on a very different level, which is that I founded a social network called AidSource along with two other people. And the idea is to connect the professionals who work in international aid and development and help people share information across organizations, across disciplines, and help break down the walls, because international aid can be very, very jargony, and it can be incredibly specialized and specific. For example, you know, the idea of positive deviance that I mentioned before tends to get limited only to nutrition. It's seen as a nutrition concept, when in fact it's useful in a lot more contexts. There's lessons that we've learned doing health projects about how adults retain information, how you can train somebody in a way that they'll actually use their new skills later instead of just using it to pass the test. And that's applicable way beyond the health sector.
We've had conversations with aid workers who talk only half jokingly about the fact that as their truck is leaving the village, the next aid group is driving into the village, and the most contact they have with each other is to sort of wave to each other on the road without sharing the knowledge that each of them has gained.
Exactly. And there isn't necessarily an organizational or systemic incentive to share that information.
Right.
Like the way funding cycles are structured, the way time works, people aren't always able to do a good clean handover that way within your sort of standard aid structure. And so the idea of AidSource is that, you know, if you're coming into a village and you know, if you're International Medical Corps, you're coming into a village to pick up a clinic or a hospital that Doctors Without Borders used to manage. Maybe you go on to AidSource and say, hey, here I am in South Sudan. I'm working in this hospital. I know that Doctors Without Borders used to be there. Does anybody know what they were doing? And then maybe they can connect on a personal level to the people who used to work there.
Oh, how wonderful. How long has AidSource been around?
We've officially opened it to everybody who wanted to join on February 14th as our Valentine to the aid work world. And we're at just around 1,000 members now.
Wow.
It seems like there was definitely a need for this.
And can you describe the kinds of members that you have, where they're coming from, who, what kinds of organizations?
It's fantastic. They are all over the place. We've got people from donor agencies who are based at headquarters. We've got aid workers who are in the field. We've got aid workers in headquarters or in major capitals. We've got educators who work in fields that relate to aid. We've got students. We've got job hunters. And we've got something like 20 different highly active discussion forums where people talk about different aid topics. We've got groups of, aid workers in Pakistan so that they can talk about Pakistan-specific issues. And I think they formed a meetup to go out for coffee or something. And the idea is that by connecting to each other as people, sharing photographs of our kids and the funny thing that happened today, it will make it easier then when we need to connect professionally, too, that we'll form a real community of practice with the focus on community.
You really are blending so many different things. We do know from things like Facebook that when we share pictures of our kids, we share other things as well. You're also blending the knowledge that we all sort of have that organizationally, folks, especially at the top of a hierarchy, may think in terms of the silos and competing and the whole we can't share any information. You said that in some cases, funding sources don't encourage. We've found in many cases, funding sources might actually be disincentives to share information because at the top, we're competing for resources. So much of what we find, though, is that the folks that are actually doing the work on the ground really want to connect.
They do. And often I think it isn't even so much that sharing is discouraged as that there's no obvious or easy way to do it. Mm-hmm. And we're hoping to be that easy, obvious way.
You had shared with me a personal story of finding that connection. Can you share that with our listeners?
I can, and it has actually genuinely changed the way I think about social media and global health. Beyond being a personal story, there's a lesson I think that I've learned from it. In February, I think it was the 21st or the 22nd, it was right close to my older son's birthday. Mm-hmm. I was getting ready to leave for a TED conference in California, and we were also involved in doing the paperwork and the routine medical visits to extend our medical clearance. Part of that involved blood draws on everybody to check us for exotic diseases and cholesterol and whatever else. And the blood draw that they did on my older son came back with a very, very high white blood cell count. I mean, very high, like 43 or 45,000. And as a rule, when the white blood cell count comes back that high, what it indicates is leukemia.
Right.
Now, it was so high that the doctor actually assumed it must be a mistake and that the machine was calibrated wrong. He suggested that we wait a week and do the blood draw again. You know, give my son a week to get over the trauma of having his blood taken because six-year-olds do not like that. And I said, I'm supposed to leave tomorrow night for California, and I'd really feel better if we get the clean blood work before I leave because otherwise I'm going to think about this the entire time.
Oh, yeah.
And so we went back in, and it was on Wednesday because I was supposed to fly out Wednesday night. And on Wednesday, we did the blood draw again, and his white blood cell count was higher.
Oh, man.
And this time we sent it out to several hospitals in Dushanbe, and we had somebody who was on their way to Turkey, and they took a blood sample to Turkey so that we could rerun it at the American Hospital in Istanbul, and it was not an anomaly. The numbers were real. And when this happens, you need a very skilled lab tech, actually, who can do some sort of special slide and look at actually what kind of white blood cells there are. Because what you're really looking for is one kind of blood cell that indicates leukemia.
Right.
And Tajikistan's just not at the point where there's those kinds of skilled lab technicians. And for that matter, if there is somebody in Tajikistan who can do that, I couldn't find them because I asked. And so we had to get my son basically to a pediatric oncologist and the accompanying lab skills pretty much as quickly as possible. So I canceled my trip to TED, called the TED people like in tears on the phone. I think I terrified them. And it was just like, I'm supposed to get on the plane. I'm not getting on the plane. I'll explain later that there's something wrong with my kid. And then we started working with the medical evacuation company and figuring out when's the next flight out of Tajikistan. And, this was a situation that was very, very urgent, but it wasn't, scramble a private jet from Moscow urgent. It was getting the next commercial flight urgent. And what we came up with our insurance company, what they were willing to cover was to put us on the next flight to Dubai. So we sat down and we figured out that my husband had something like 9 weeks of accumulated leave, and I had 11 days. So my husband decided he would take us on the medevac. And on Saturday night, I put them on the flight to Dubai, but what they didn't have on the other end was a doctor's appointment. Because our medevac company was more used to people who'd, you know, broken two arms and a leg and needed emergency services and didn't really have a lot of connections or experience trying to find a pediatric oncologist in Dubai.
Wow.
So they were doing their best, but they weren't coming up with anything.
Right.
And the clinic that we were working with in Dushanbe was doing their best too, but they weren't coming up with anything either. And meanwhile, the weekend in Dubai is a Friday, Saturday weekend, so the first working day that they're going to be there was Sunday. And I think like any mom, I wanted my son in there seeing the pediatric oncologist on Sunday.
Now.
Because with leukemia, if you can catch it before the white blood cells cross 50,000, then you have a much better cure rate. Now, as a health professional, I have to stop here and tell you that pediatric leukemia actually has a really excellent cure rate in general. But it's a horrible, horrible treatment and nothing anyone wants their child to go through.
I can't imagine.
Catching it very early improves your odds even more. Mm-hmm. And so I was determined that I wanted to get him to the doctor on Sunday. Because if it was leukemia, then they were going to get on the next flight to Boston out of Dubai and start treatment immediately.
Wow.
And so I put this call out on Twitter. I put a note on Twitter that said basically, we had this medical situation that was suspected leukemia. Could anybody recommend or give us contact information for a pediatric oncologist in Dubai?
Now, can you share with our listeners how many Twitter followers you have? Because what we're used to hearing is somebody with 100,000 Twitter followers that can put a call out and anything can happen. How many Twitter followers do you have?
At the time, I had about 6,000.
Okay. It's more than a couple of hundred, but it's certainly not rock star.
Right. I'm not Ashton Kutcher or anything. And I thought that, you know, maybe somebody would be able to tell me, oh, my cousin's an oncologist, or I know somebody who's an oncologist. I thought someone would give me an email address, and that maybe I could use the email address to track down a phone number or something.
Right.
And instead, what happened was this amazing outpouring of love and support for us, where there were people who were calling around and tracking down contacts in Dubai for me. There were groups of people, more than one group of people, trying to get us this appointment. People that I'd spoken to on the telephone, people I'd never seen before, people I didn't know were following me on Twitter. Mm. And it was just amazing how hard they were willing to work for this child that they'd never seen. Mm. And, you know, I'm not a parent who puts my son on the internet much. Like, I try to keep my kids mainly out of my social media life, out of paranoia, I guess.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't even that they felt really any particular connection to him because he hadn't been a big feature on my blog or anything. And then one particular group of people who I had collaborated on a project once, knew a guy who knew a guy who was living in Dubai. And his name was Johan. And Johan managed to track down the phone numbers for the people that he needed to talk to in the oncology department at the American Hospital in Dubai. And he called them, and he called them, and he called them.
Oh, my gosh.
And by the time, and then my husband, like, you know, 9 a.m., first moment of business hours in Dubai, upon arrival, called the American Hospital, and basically, when he got through, they said, oh, it's you, and they made an appointment. My husband sent me this email that was like, I don't know how many people called the hospital for us, but they knew we were coming. Meanwhile, poor Johan had actually ended up as our point of contact in the hospital's information system, and he continued to get all the phone calls as they set up the appointments.
Now, tell us how your son is.
Was not cancer.
Oh.
They still don't know what it was, but it's gone. His white blood cells are back down to normal. He's been medically cleared and returned to Dushanbe. He had to take a very strong course of Cipro, which is a broad-spectrum antibiotic, which I think is probably the doctors just feeling like they should do something.
Wow.
Because he basically already fought off the infection by the time they saw him. And, you know, if I was a less paranoid mommy, I think if we waited a week and done the blood draw again, we would have missed the whole thing because it would have been normal.
I don't know that there is such a thing as a less paranoid mommy.
Very true.
I think that goes with the territory. I have to take a deep breath after your story to relate that now to what you learned from that in the broader picture. Now that you are able to look at it more objectively, what did you learn from that that has to do with this connectedness? Because clearly this is a story of connectedness.
Well, I used to be very skeptical about the potential of social media to improve global health. Because I didn't think there was any obvious mechanism. Like, I didn't think there was any clear way that this technology was going to intersect with global health in a useful way. And what this experience made me realize is that there is, and that it's basically, how do I frame this? There was a Facebook discussion, actually, amongst the TED fellows about what happened with my son, because I ended up telling them about it to explain why I hadn't been at the conference. And what somebody asked was, you know, well, how do you become that kind of connector? Like, clearly you're a connector. How do I become a connector? Mm-hmm. And I realized the real question isn't how can one person become a connector, but how can everybody become a connector? Mm. How do we build a world where everybody can access that kind of network when they need it? And it isn't necessarily going to be an American expatriate in Tajikistan trying to find a pediatric oncologist in Dubai.
Right.
It might be as simple as a woman in a Tajik village who needs a gynecologist she can trust. Or it might be somebody who they have a question about health and they need to know who the person is that they can ask will have an answer for them. Very recently, a friend of a friend of a friend in Tajikistan had a baby born who was missing a hand. Mm-hmm. And there are NGOs in Tajikistan that provide counseling and services to parents of children with disabilities. Right. And that NGO would be able to help them, but they don't even know this NGO exists because they've never had a child with a disability before. So the question is, how do we give everybody a network so that they can reach out for this information and get it back? And so that's what I've been thinking about. And even in rural areas, we've seen in rural Africa, in Central Asia, people are using smartphones, people are text messaging. And I think that once we can start connecting people, it will give them the ability to start solving their own problems.
Absolutely.
And when they think of a solution, it'll give them the ability to reach out and grab that solution instead of knowing what they need and not knowing how to find it.
What you're really talking about is creating a social infrastructure of connection.
Yes.
And creating those systems. It's so interesting that when we talk about infrastructure, we're so used to thinking about physical infrastructure and financial infrastructure. But the thing that we hear over and over and over again is that the thing that makes the biggest difference is that social infrastructure. And how do we consciously create that?
Yes. And, you know, as you pointed out, 7,000 Twitter followers isn't some giant amount.
Right.
I will tell you that I have met people who are natural connectors in person. Mm-hmm. Charismatic people who remember everybody's name and everybody's face. My father was a college professor. He remembered every student he ever taught. I think he actually had 7,000 or 8,000 people that he knew personally and would recognize when he met them.
Wow.
I am not that person. And without social media to support me, I wouldn't be able to maintain that many connections because I'm kind of awkward in person. I do really well when I can condense my thoughts to 140 characters and put them out there with a little bit of editing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably true for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so I think there has to be a way that we can take this technology and leverage it into something that lets everybody become a connector on their own terms.
It's a fascinating concept. And I think that it goes beyond just the technology. The technology is one of the ways, but creating the social infrastructure that brings people together, that serves as that connection. It's something that we see again and again. And it's what you are actually doing with AidSource. Is you're providing, yes, you're using technology to do it, but you're providing the means to convene, to bring people together, and then letting whatever's going to happen is going to happen because of what they're bringing together.
Yes.
Alana, this has been so interesting, so heartfelt. Thank you so much for sharing your personal story. And I'm so excited about what AidSource is doing. I'm really looking forward to checking in with you a year or two from now to hear the stories of what folks have been able to accomplish that they never could have accomplished. You know, one of the questions I frequently ask groups when I'm convening them is, what can we accomplish together that none of us can accomplish on our own? And I'm really looking forward to seeing how AidSource comes up with answers to that question.
So am I have to say. I think we're going in some very interesting directions.
You've got a great start. I can't wait to see where it goes. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for talking to me.
Speaking with Alana reminds all of us that creating a better world is not just an abstract concept. It is deeply personal, affecting each of us. We all live on this planet. We all live in the communities we want to see be whole and healthy. I'm so grateful to Alana for sharing her stories, and especially her own personal story, which makes her message that much more powerful. We all have our own stories. That's not just how we connect with each other. It has been, for thousands of years, how we humans have survived, connecting with stories of where the ground is fertile, where animals graze, how to predict when the rains may fall, how to care for each other generation after generation. Our stories are what connect us to wisdom, to each other. That is precisely what Alana and her partners are doing with AidSource, giving people a platform for sharing their stories, what's working, what isn't, ways to learn from each other. It's clearly at the heart of what she's noticed really creates health, people's abilities to share information, share their stories of what works and why. And obviously, that ability to connect with someone's story was at the heart of her own personal journey when her own son became ill. We humans want to connect. We want to share our stories. What is missing is the platform, the convening places, the systems that make that connection easy. Which leads to questions for your own work. What have you seen work well for giving people the opportunity to connect? How can we tap into the gifts of everyone whose lives are touched by the work we do in our communities so that, as Alana suggests, everyone can become a connector on their own terms? What opportunities might you provide at every meeting, in every interaction with the public, for people to share their stories, to connect with their wisdom and their experience? As you begin exploring these big questions, I hope you'll share your observations at the Chronicle's website, philanthropy.com, and at Creating the Future's Facebook page at facebook.com/creatingthefuture. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me through our website at creatingthefuture.org or on Twitter at Hildy Gottlieb. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and our world. For the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hildy Gottlieb. We'll see you the second Thursday of next month here on Making Change.